This tape is an update of a recording first made in 1982 in upstate New York before a small audience. The essential material is an urgent message from an extraterrestrial source. For the benefit of those who know nothing about this material, I'm going to give a short introduction as to what is coming.
Everybody is not here, and what I'm going to do very specifically is for the benefit of my good friend Sam Lantine, I'm going to recap in 5 minutes everything that I said. So he's a very bright fellow, so he'll catch up with us, and maybe it'll help all of us. So I'll speak very directly to Sam while all of you get yourself settled down. What I'm talking about is extraterrestrial contacts. And it started with Uri Geller on August 18, 1971, when he put his hand over my wristwatch and advanced to 32 minutes. And ever since then, it moves by itself without Uri being around at all. Eventually, I found out it was an extraterrestrial group. It took me 3.5 years to crack the code, which is rather sophisticated, but it depends on the angle that two clock hands make on a 24-hour clock, and this is a superimposed over a 38-section wheel, which has 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet and 10 numbers, and then there are stops, blank spots for various stop purposes. I really began to understand the code in 1975, and what I found out then was that it was predicting events for the next 20 or 30 years. And so for the last 7 years, from 1982 now, back to 1975, I was able to check the predictions made by this message that came through the clock against events, and the events, almost without exception, were natural events. When the next big earthquake would occur, what would happen, weather patterns, floods, rains, heavy snow, cold, etc. And I'm reasonably satisfied that whoever is, and I describe in some detail to the group here, who is behind the clock. I won't go into that right now because I'm sure it'll come up again. But it's a reliable source that suits my standards of ethics and morality, and I believe that this person who is behind it is a good person and has only the welfare of mankind at heart. And although maybe separately the precise identification of who that person is. So I'm satisfied that the person is alive and here, that my code was correct, that is the decoding, and that I was being given a true picture of what is going to happen. So up till yesterday, we reached a point, well, people are still coming in, I'm going to read rapidly the key points of what has been deciphered from this code, Sam, and you can just follow it. Rather simple. It starts out as follows. This is the book of seven seals of Tav. Tav is equivalent to the Omega of the Christian Bible. And it will be opened within 56 days, that is by December 1st, 1975. The season of harvest and of labor pains begins for the earth, as it is written. It begins in this year. Again, signed by Tav. Starting on February 4, 1976, there will be 1,369 shakings of the earth. And this is signed by three people, Aleph, Atz, and Taf. This will be followed by earthquakes and cataclysms for 90 months. Land and mountains will melt and shake and sink in the following 80 months. We are entering the 80-month period, which runs from August 24th, that's next week, 1982, to August 17th, 1988.
revised edition, I am correcting a few data points which are improperly recorded in 1982. Quote, the new age begins in 4,668 days. Then the work of Shin ends on September 9th, 2000.
The 135 plus Aleph, Aleph being the Greek, I mean the Hebrew, for beginning of the alphabet, the principles, the divine ones, will arrange to bring forth to your hand the new rootstock, the foundation for the destined new race of humanity during the coming 3,480 days. And this period covers 1975 to 1985. During the last 46 months of this period, secret knowledge will be brought forward from behind the veil. Again, signed by Aleph.
Prepare to sustain yourself for 10 years, 1989 to 1999, in mountain strongholds, fortified against all destructive effects, a fortress. You have until 1989 to prepare it. Make it secure against your adversaries or alternative explanation, all adversities.
A 4 times 6, which means 24 civilizations, its prince, the head of the 24 civilizations, the hidden one, the divine one, and he is indicated as Rosh, the Hebrew letter Rosh, will appear in 2,560 days. For each and every one to see. That would be December 4th, 1st of the 4th, 1982, this year. Tremble at the mention of the divine name, purify yourself, signed Tav. The 135 will come in 89 months, that is, up to the period of August 20th, this week again, 1982, signed Aleph twice. Humble yourself, signed Tav.
The 135 begot of Aleph and the 24 beginning in 1988 will minister to ensure that the mountain stronghold is kept secret and secure for the He and the Vav, that is the 5 and the 6, the archetypes of universal life gathered as the rootstock from the 135 principles, the seeds for future humanity.
So that's as far as we got yesterday, and I'm sorry I can't repeat saying all the verification of all those events, but everything as said has been done, verified, double-checked, etc., okay? And feel free to just ask any questions to fill in the hole. Now I will continue because this is going to be a little slow, and today I'm going to be decent to you and give you a break at 10 o'clock.
I guess I'm going to catch up with you. I want to find out how many of you were at the lecture yesterday. Okay, just about everybody. I realized, and I know before I first gave the talk, that I'm dumping an awful lot of stuff on you which is in contradiction to many of the sacred beliefs that we hold in the Western world. And I don't want to be totally out of phase with you. I don't want to really ask you to accept anything unless we've had a chance to discuss it first. And so I would really welcome questions from each of you just to get us on the same track, and then I'll go with the on with the didactic material about things that I said that either bother you or that you think maybe amplify some of the beliefs you have. So if you'll just put your thinking caps on, I think maybe we could start a little discussion here just so we all get on the same wavelength. Anybody have any questions or problems? Yes.
You mentioned that children are not born.
And as an advisor, are aware of what's going on. Somehow they know. And some lady came up to me yesterday, I don't know if she's here or not, who's already had two children by this means. And there's another gentleman whose wife already had a child. Without reading a book or being coached, they already knew. They had visions. Typically, they usually know the moment of conception. And they describe what happened. And it's not at all a kind of a sexual apparatus type of examination. It really is a kind of beam of light that enters them. It has a certain form. Maybe some of it's symbolic, but there's a ray of light, and there's a circle, and this ray of light penetrates the circle. And this part here is the part that has the implanted genetic material. Since this is going on all over the planet, I obviously am not in touch with every woman who is bearing a child this way, so I don't really know the total experience, but I'm sure as we begin to talk about these things, it will come out in human data, people will get together and exchange the information, but that's the best information I have at the moment. Yes?
How am I looking so good?
Yeah, they go through the entire appearance of pregnancy. Their breasts get enlarged, they have sensitivity of the breast. They do get large, though they were having a normal pregnancy. But the children are so tiny, and it's hardly to believe that they're almost what we call premature infants. But they're perfectly formed, but they're usually about 2 pounds maximum. I think the biggest one I personally have to remember from yesterday, there are 2 kinds of birth. One is where the child simply dematerializes from the mother and is gone. And where they go, I still don't know. I expect that somewhere up in a spaceship or another planet, being tossed with waves, and then eventually they'll just teleport back to Earth and then back again. When that phase occurs, it's going to be a whole new mystery. There will be a lot of unusual people on the planet. The other kind is delivered to the normal parturition channel, has a baby that's very small, but nevertheless very perfectly formed, and they grow up like other children, and they themselves don't realize who they are at the moment of waking, becomes much later in life. So the mother does go through the whole cycle she would normally go through in giving birth. I don't know when mankind was last exposed to this kind of cycle of experience, but to begin with, when the mother is carrying the child, I first observed it in 1979, actually a little earlier, 78, and the child that was being carried had suddenly disappeared because I was following the development of the child every day by palpation and by listening to the heartbeat and so on, and one day I suddenly discovered they were gone, or the child was gone that day. And I didn't dare tell the mother, of course, it could be quite a shock. But in a couple of days, the child came back. It came and went, and came and went, and came and went. So the first mystery begins, where does the child go? And it dematerializes from the body. And obviously, you stop to think about it, the power to dematerialize a living thing intact, you know, through the walls of the body, and then has to be teleported somewhere to an equivalent environment. You stop thinking about it. Don't think it.
What about
the body?
Well, when you feel the uterus of the woman, all the fluid is intact, it's within, everything is in there, but the body is missing. And I don't know where the umbilicus goes to. And then the child, of course, I say, but first, let me just backtrack, because we're dumping some very heavy information on you. You have to have gone through the whole experience. A lot of people on the planet now have, ever since 1971, of first seeing a thing like this, dematerialized from here, and when you get home, the thing is on your desk. But you have to get used to this idea that it's possible to collapse every atom of which this is made into another space. It's like turning over. Mathematically, it's quite correct. And then there's no travel in any sense that we know of a thing traveling through space. It just folds over into another dimension. We live in a four-dimensional world. This falls into an eight-dimensional manifold, and it is, when it turns back, it's in the target area now. Just that little phenomenon alone is just mind-boggling, and we've exposed, I say we, the group that has developed all this stuff since 1971, we've exposed many physicists and scientists to this phenomenon. And I first told you the little story about what happened at SRI with the clock, and I could repeat the same story from many other centers of research. So that's one thing you have to get in your mind, that this is physically possible to cause an object and a living thing also to disappear here and reappear somewhere else intact without a hair being changed. And I haven't told you this part of the story because, again, it's mind-boggling. But the first time I observed it was when Uri Geller disappeared in Israel. This was on December 1st, 1971. He just vanished from a room, and he showed up about 40 minutes later. Found him in an elevator, just standing like one of these Star Trek robots, beam up, beam down stuff, and he didn't know where he was, and I had no real proof that he had actually disappeared and so on. I mean, the evidence was not that strong. He just disappeared and we found him again. But that's the whole story in itself. But the first time I really was absolutely certain that teleportation of a living being occurred and I could follow the process was when New York, where he lived in an apartment on 57th Street, and I lived about 36 miles north in Westchester County, a place called Ossining. And Uri was running down the street, he likes to jog, and he just suddenly felt himself being pulled backwards and then lifted, and then the next thing he knew, he woke up in my living room. But what in fact happened was I was alone in my house, it's a fairly big house, and I heard something hit the house. And I thought my first thought was that the furnace in the basement had exploded because of that kind of a sound which I'd heard before. And I went to the furnace and it was running quiet away, nothing was wrong with it. And I searched the house and I couldn't find any reason. Then the next thought was that a tree had fallen in our house, which is possible. Couldn't find any tree falling. Then suddenly I heard a whimpering sound and I went out on the porch and the mystery was solved and I saw a big hole in the screen, aluminum screen, screening of this porch, and there on the floor was a crumpled up Uri Geller. He'd been hurled right through the screen, hit a huge table which had about 6 feet diameter, made of heavy maple with a glass top on it. What had happened, he'd been thrown through and hit the table, and the table had hit the house, and that's what gave it that explosive sound. Anyway, I was terribly concerned because he hit this glass top. And it was glass everywhere. And I thought, my God, he must have 1,000 puncture holes in him. But make a long story short, there was no puncture holes. He was not injured. He was just dazed by the process of being dematerialized, teleported, and rematerialized. And he was intact. And I checked him from top to bottom, and there was nothing had changed. His memory was now scrambled. And since then, I've had a lot of experience with other people physically teleporting. So you have to go through this knowledge before I tell you that babies can dematerialized, you know, from a mother, go somewhere else, be cared for, obviously, in some kind of a super incubator system, and return to the mother. Now, when you work with a mother and they get trained, I've never found a mother that can tell when the child disappears. But they do know when the child reappears because they feel the fullness and they feel the little kicking movements and so on. So they do learn to detect when the child returns. But I don't know if that explains anything, but I'm trying to tell you that this phenomenon has been studied on the bench, so to speak, and physicists have documented that physical objects in the presence of somebody who has this power can dematerialize, be teleported elsewhere, and then rematerialize. Now, I use the word teleport, and it's not exactly accurate because all my observations so far show that objects tend to simply vanish in this point in time space, and they just reappear in another place. And let me give you a little example of that. And SRI, when the work, the original work was being done in 72 and 73 on Geller as the test subject, and these kind of things have been done with other people since then, I mentioned to you that one of the cameras had the power supply disappear from it. The camera under the table that was recording the possibility of an object materializing in its field of view. Well, it was a very expensive Aeroflex camera, and it had for a power supply a battery pack that was encased in the aluminum housing of the battery of the camera. And what had happened was that the batteries had dematerialized from the metal housing of the Aeroflex, and it's a good tight seal for a battery, and it had reappeared in the photographer's darkroom, which was about 60 feet down the hall of the building, and the batteries had appeared on the desk. Okay, so you see what's going on? The battery is strained through aluminum metal. Now that alone boggles our mind how matter can pass through matter. Theoretically, we have an explanation on a quantum mechanical level, but on a macroscopic level, there is no explanation. We don't know how this happened. And the batteries reappear intact, and they're working batteries. They're not damaged or destroyed. So this is the basic thing that we're talking about. Now, when we get, as I say, to the biological level, we're in a whole different order of magnitude, because every one of us knows that if we get our brains a little scrambled with alcohol or a drug or an allergic reaction or something, we really get terrible scrambling up of the memory that's in our brain. And you imagine taking the 20 billion or so cells apart, each one of which is made up of some 1 billion atoms, and then reassembling them somewhere without any time being lost, so to speak. It's just beyond our comprehension. So we try to dump that into the class of miracles, and that's what mankind has always done, because these things have been observed over the years, over the millennia. We are having some success, and our first publication in this area is something called the Iceland Papers, which tries to deal with this phenomenon, and to a certain extent it does deal with it successfully on the micro level, where you're dealing with a few atoms or a few molecules, but it has... There's nothing in the equations we've developed so far that tells you how you can take an embryo, especially a growing embryo. You have to remember it's growing very rapidly, changing, how it can go from here to there and back over and over and be intact. So we can't really deal with it, but we are trying, and there are a lot of physicists who are working on the problem. I don't know if that answers your question. Yes, Tom?
When I was reading a book here very years ago, I wondered why all these dematerializations were happening, and who was responsible? Was it the dying that was involved?
You mean the actual control behind it?
Yeah, like why was there a dematerializing?
Okay, now that's a question that's going to take a long answer. Tom is a professor of physics, so he's going to ask the question that's going to make me work. All right, let's see if we can go back a little bit.
Demonstrate something? Were they trying to demonstrate this possibility?
The what?
Were they trying to demonstrate this power? whoever we're responsible for that.
Who? The only time they've been demonstrated is, you know, under laboratory conditions from 22 universities and so on. Everybody's got some kind of evidence. John Hainstead has got evidence of teleportation of metals, and the group at London University under David Bohm placed crystals in sealed plastic containers, and parts of it disappeared and didn't. And Geller will take a watch where we take a piece out to make it work, and he'll concentrate on it, make it work, and take it apart, put a new piece in there, that sort of thing, okay? So that has been done. I can't do it for you, but that's the real extent of your question. Maybe we have some psychic who is good at teleportation or something like that. Let me just finish the whole question here. I think the deeper intent of your question is, who is the stage manager of all this operation, really? I mean, ultimately, that's it. And that's the question we all, I say all, people like myself, evade, because it's really beyond our comprehension. And but I will tell you as best as I understand the phenomenon, okay? Have any of you read the book that I wrote about this phenomenon called Uri?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a few of you read it. Let me start here at the beginning. My first encounter with the director of the operations was as follows. I'd set up an experiment with Geller in Israel in December of 1971, which is a very simple experiment. I took a Parker pen like this, except the housing was all of plastic. It was some fancy name for the Parker model, the one with the little arrow on it. And I put it in a wooden box like this, except longer, and I sealed the box. And I asked Uri to concentrate on that box and do what he could. Now, this is the first time this phenomenon happened to him. So he wasn't sure what was going to happen. He just put his hand over the box. Had a movie camera running in case I would record anything. And after a short time, only about 10 seconds, he said, "Okay, I think it happened." I said, "What do you think happened?" He said, "I don't know, but something happened. I feel it." So I opened up the box, picked up the pen, and it was there. It was intact, but I immediately noticed that it was lighter. And what had happened when I opened up the pen is that the brass filler cartridge from the inside had disappeared. So again, you have a phenomena of metal and some liquid being strained through a metal jacket and a plastic jacket, and all without any thermal changes or any other obvious thermodynamic effects. Well, I thought that was a good experiment. At least he could disappear objects. And I asked him if he could bring it back. Well, he just wasn't up to it that particular day. Subsequently, we did do experiments where he would make objects disappear from a box and then bring them back. But at this point, he had not advanced to that level. So he got a little antsy at this point, said he had a date with his girlfriend and wanted me to go with him. They were out being a third wheel. I think they would be great helpful with his girlfriend. But we went to his girlfriend's apartment. His name was Iris. And he was hungry and he wanted something to eat right away and wanted to get out of there. So he said, "Make me some eggs." So she went to the refrigerator where all the eggs were stored cold and reached in to pick out some eggs. And surprised, she picked up hot eggs as though they'd come out of boiling water. At this point, he had not advanced to that level. So he got a little antsy at this point, said he had a date with his girlfriend and wanted me to go with him. They were out being a third wheel. I think they would be great helpful with his girlfriend. But we went to his girlfriend's apartment. His name was Iris. And he was hungry and he wanted something to eat right away and wanted to get out of there.
So he said, make me some eggs. So she went to the refrigerator where all the eggs were stored cold and reached in to pick out some eggs. And surprised, she picked up hot eggs as though they'd come out of boiling water. In other words, they were done. So we all ate the eggs that were instantly done, real quick, and Uri was angry as the dickens and said, we've got to get out of here. Now, I had no idea what was on his mind. I was dealing with a kind of a wild young horse who wasn't trained and was always champing at the bit to do something. So I just went along with it since I didn't know what was going on. So he ran to the car, we jumped in, and he and his girlfriend sat in front and drove. I sat in the back, and Uri said, now, you, pointing to me, you've got to tell me where to go. I said, I don't know this town. It was in Tel Aviv, Israel. He said, it doesn't matter. You tell me what to do. So I decided I'd play along with the game. So I just said, go straight, turn left, turn right. Just random, I thought, random. And we went on for miles, and I suddenly said, well, stop. And as we stopped, we all heard a sound in the air. It was like, puck, 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 a little faster than that. We got out, and we heard the sound, then a physical sound that was quite distinct. And we climbed up a large embankment where a grader had been working and piled up a huge kind of a dam. We went over the hill, looked down into an excavation, is what it was, for some kind of a building. And there we saw a strobe light going, puck, 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 puck. I've never seen that particular color of blue light. And then it was dark. I didn't give you all the time sequences, but it was dark, but dusk. And we could see under the light ovoid form and some what appeared to be legs. In other words, what people call a UFO. And there was a certain gleam that came off the metal from the light above it. So I said, really, we're going to see a UFO. I was thrilled, and Uri was very serious suddenly, and his girlfriend started shaking, and I said, let's go and get aboard it. So we walked toward it, and Uri stopped me at one point and said, you can't go aboard, only I can go aboard. He said, you take care of yours. So there I was, you know, bereft and chipped out of a big adventure. So anyway, I had a movie camera with me, and I just kept shooting, even though it was dark. I had rather fast film, thought I might get something, at least the light. So I just kept shooting and calming down this girl who was just there rattling and she was just all falling apart. Anyway, it seemed like an eternity, but it was only about 20 minutes that Uri reappeared from the craft. And he came walking toward me like a man who was in trance. He was like this. And he was really like a Frankenstein scene. It was kind of amusing. And as he reached me, what was in his hand was the missing brass cartridge from the Parker pen. Now, I might tell you that I'm a pretty good researcher. Before I'd done this experiment, I scratched on each part a number, so there couldn't be any switching of parts. And the number that I had scratched on the cartridge was on there. Okay, there's a big moral in that story. Question number one is, with respect to Uri, who's really doing the manipulating? Back to your question. Well, in that case, to me, it was quite clear that it wasn't Uri who had made a part of the pen disappear, but it was somebody in a spacecraft. And secondly, to teach me a little lesson, which is all it wasn't anything very important, it was brought back to me under these very peculiar circumstances. So, you want to know who was in the craft, right? So I interrogated Uri immediately, even though I was still a little shaky, and he made a whole series, a very good draftsman, made a whole series of drawings of the interior of the craft and was aware of the function of various parts. And there was only one person aboard, in quotes. But Uri told me this was not a person. He looked like a person, except for the clothing. It was a little odd, kind of a dome-shaped head and hat or whatever it was. But these were robots, but they were just as smart, or probably more smart than any of us in this room. And I later found out, through a long series of communications, again to answer your questions, what happened one day, Uri and I were sitting down, I always had tape recording cameras around, to talk at a table. And I put the tape recorder down, and before I had started it, we were just chatting before we actually got into the meat of the purpose of the meeting. And the tape recorder had buttons. This was 11 years ago. They weren't as fancy as they are today. Fairly big, and there were buttons for every function. And I just, looking at this thing, I saw the two buttons for record go be pressed down. And I thought, is that already doing some PK, or that's something else? Well, I found out it was something else because I put a monitor earphone into the machine, and the wheels were going, and I heard a voice being imprinted on the tape. This is those being recorded, but there was no voice in the environment. Make a long story short, there were many, 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 many such communications, usually 2 to 4 hours long. The extraterrestrials were using the tape recorder to imprint their voice, and then when I would talk, of course, the microphone would pick up normally and record, and I had a two-way conversation going with somebody out there in space. And I report a lot of the details of those conversations. Actually, the conversations cover about 14 volumes this size, so what I put in here is just obviously tip of the iceberg. But I found out a number of things. Again, I'm really trying to answer your question, and I think everybody's interested. What seems to happen is the following, or the way the system works, is you have us on a little ball called Earth here. And overhead somewhere is a little disc-shaped craft. They're very small, anywhere from 2 feet to 9 feet. They're not very big. That are manned by robots. And they monitor everything that's going on within their sphere of influence. And that means, and I've had absolute proof of this, that they can influence your thinking. They can do telekinetic phenomena for you. They can make you see things that aren't there, and so on. In other words, they have total mind control if they so wish to exercise it. Light years away in time, this could be millions of light years for that matter, if a problem rises that's beyond the capacity of this little robot to take care of, it relays the message on to another robot. And that robot, if the message can't be handled from here, relays the message to another craft that could be in another part of the galaxy or another part of the universe. And this one has what we call beings aboard, living beings, they're not robots. And they have pure mental control over anything that happens here. And so they rarely get alarm signals to look at something. Kind of thing they would be concerned about if a nuclear event was to happen on Earth, they would relay it back. Or something big has to go on, like, when I say big, I mean the appearance of an avatar like Jesus Christ or Buddha. They're always connected to these kind of things. And that's what we think of as the connection to God. Let us not delude ourselves. No person on earth has a direct connection to God. This is impossible in the nature of the space-time manifold of the universe and where God as an intelligence actually exists. I mean, to put it very simply, he is everywhere, but he's also in any given point. And this is a little beyond what the Sunday Bible class will teach you. Now, who are the beings that are involved here? I mentioned to you yesterday that the person in charge of the local situation, this means many galaxies, not just Earth, is the one I mentioned in the lecture, which is in the book, where 9 pens fell this way, 4, 5, 6, 7. That is the person from the civilization of Huba who's in charge of this particular galaxy, and his name, as I told you yesterday, is Yehuva. This is I don't know how many of you are familiar with Hebrew, but Hebrew, when it was originally written, is not like the Hebrew we know today. For example, this would be an Aleph. The way we do it today, but The original Hebrew was written like this, as though you would drop sticks. I don't know if any of you ever looked up the 1000 BC Sinaitic form of Hebrew. It was closer to what we came to know as Phoenician, which was one of the derivatives of Hebrew language, and which became the parent of the Greek language, and the Greek language is one of the root languages, along with Sanskrit, of our Indo-European languages, and English is one of the offshoots of that line. And so if you want to know the real meaning of any word in English, you can always trace it back to Greek, and you can trace it back to Sanskrit. Even though the alphabetic form changes, the root meanings are all constant. They're vast etymological dictionaries about it. So anyway, Yehovah is in charge of a certain part of this universe, and he is in charge. I might say that Yehovah simply means the leader of the civilization of Yehovah. It's a title, it's not a name. And the Hebrews knew this, and they call it, at least we say, it was Yahweh in the Bible. But the Hebrews themselves probably lost the Hebrew-speaking people and the Judaic people probably lost the true pronunciation of that name. And as any of you are Jewish, know you're never supposed to pronounce that name in the Bible. You just skip over it. And so they lost the real meaning. We, of course, call it Jehovah and all kind of other names, variations of that, depending on which language culture you come from. But anyway, he's in charge of this part of the universe, but he is in charge of what we call something, it's a new term, and probably not meaningful, bioengineering. Bioengineering means being responsible for the creation of all life on a planet. There can be millions of planets in which this civilization is in charge of that particular aspect. And the problem of bioengineering is enormous. As you probably know, there are more than a million species of life on Earth, and it's a very intricate life chain. I don't want to go into all the details, but in order to have the kind of life that we have, when the planet was first formed, it was what was called a reducing atmosphere. There was no oxygen. It took a long line of evolution to go from something called chlorophyll, I'll just indicate it by C, which can capture a photon of light, release an electron, and in the process of the things around it, split water, HOH, into hydrogen and oxygen. And once you get oxygen, then the atmosphere has to be filled with it, and that takes a long time because all the oxygen has to be produced from this process, so the energy comes from the sun. And when we reach a stage of evolution of mammals, which is what we are a part of, we breathe in the oxygen, and the hydrogen has been built into carbohydrates, sugars mostly, and the whole metabolic process in us simply concerns stripping hydrogen atoms off of sugar, and they go through a long, complicated, so-called terminal respiratory chain, and the hydrogen combines with O2, and the net result is H2O. So, the entire plant domain captures the light from the sun, splits water so that we have separate oxygen in the atmosphere, hydrogen built on the carbohydrate CO2, and then we breathe in the CO2, we get the oxygen, that's the entire cycle of life in a nutshell. If they never told you this in biology, don't be surprised, because they never tell you the simple thing. But that's life. All of life is in that one process. Anyway, that is all planned by sentient, conscious beings. Now, unfortunately, as human beings, we have a tendency to worship anybody who's smarter than us, which is a fundamental mistake we make. You should never worship anybody. You might admire them, you might pay homage, but not worship. Anyway, I think the primitive early Hebrews, and this goes back probably to the time of Abraham, obviously sitting in a desert, somebody coming down in a spaceship, as I've described to you, and somebody comes out with a shiny suit, they think it's God right away. So we've always made the mistake of equating Yehovah and El Shaddai and Shavuot from the Bible with God. This is a mistake. God is way, 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 way beyond in the hierarchy of things from these highly evolved beings who are in charge of various parts of the universe and the planet. Now, Huva is only one of 24 civilizations that are concerned not only with Earth, but millions and millions of places like Earth, and each one of them has a different function, Yehuva being the life organizer. Now, the question then is, who is behind all the phenomena that we are dealing with today? Notice some very interesting things which no scientist of our day or sociologist has even bothered to look at. First, as far as we know historically, even though, and all of you here know this to be true, there are things called poltergeists. In other words, there aren't just space beings, there are all sorts of souls around here. Most of the souls that hang around Earth are people who've been here and just don't want to leave and go back to their home base. And these are the spirits that you deal with. The spirits also deal with these kind of higher beings. And so spirits have just as much power as we do if they choose to, as you all know, and they can communicate very easily with people. They can also create physical effects, and that's the area that's called poltergeist. When I first brought Uri and all the kids who followed him, thousands and thousands of people do the same thing as Uri, to the attention of the world, everybody said, oh, I know that, that's a poltergeist. Well, they didn't know what a poltergeist was. Nothing to do with a poltergeist. Poltergeist activity is from the spirit domain to the earth domain. The kind of things we're talking about, and I haven't even gone into all the details of materialization, teleportation, dematerialization, levitation, come from this domain of being. This domain exercised the influence here. People who are on earth who are highly evolved can easily acquire these powers on their own, given certain conditions. So you have a number of different things going on. I just want to clearly differentiate poltergeist phenomena. But the point I was going to make is that when Uri, as the forerunner, appeared with these powers, it's the first time in thousands and thousands of years. We have to go back literally almost to the time of Noah to find events like this going on. It isn't that Uri is anybody special. He's just another messenger boy, as most of us are. But he did have the effect, and it was very complex, so complex that I say nobody's there to deal with it. When you stop to think of the phenomena that Uri Geller gets on television, and people at home, and there was a lady who came up to me, I don't know if she's still here, from Munich, who was in Germany when we first exposed Uri to Europe, who was sitting at home and had a fork or something bend in her hand just while watching him. So when Geller got on television, thousands of people had the same, doing the same thing he did, like that. You have to remember that the control is up here, not in the television network, not in the person, not in Geller himself. Higher power, it's not even a higher power, it's only a robot created by a higher being. But still, it's all within the domain of what we can comprehend, and there's nothing holy about it, there's nothing special. It's just more advanced organization of consciousness and intelligence is all we're dealing with. And I don't mean to lower the phenomena, it is extraordinary, excites our wonder and interest, but it is not in the realm of anything magical, it's all comprehensible. And the other point is that when Geller would get on television and spread this, the other people who were awakened just by watching him would go on and keep doing it. That's where we got our thousands and thousands of subjects to study in the laboratory, and they all went on to have individual careers. But even more remarkable is when the thing that Geller is doing is put on videotape. I don't know how many of you experienced this, but if you show that tape to a number of people and they sit in front of the video screen that's coming off a tape that may have been done 2 years ago and hold on to a piece of metal, the metal will bend. Okay? So you're dealing, and no sociologist, no scientist has had the guts, the imagination to even begin to deal with this phenomenon. And oh well, I can deal with bending a piece of metal, but having it broadcast, having it live on tape, no, it's a...
I have a couple of questions. Just try to understand yours about 35 years old.
Yeah, 47.
Does he have any control over this teleportation or making things disappear? I mean, is it, like when you were talking about when he was physically teleported to your house in Westchester? Can he control that, or
is
it just
happening? No. He has control over little things that any of us could control. He can do telepathy, he can do clairvoyance, he can be a medium if he so chooses, contact either spirit things or higher order intelligences. But the big things he has no control over, like getting on BBC and turning on thousands, tens of thousands of people. That he had no control. When he was teleported, I think about four times that I have personally witnessed, he has no idea it's going to happen. He doesn't even remember where he goes. From other people who have teleported, I've been able to reconstruct the picture of where they go and how they come back, etc. So I personally would say, and I think he would disagree, that about 95% of things that he's capable of, he does not have control of. He is simply a puppet, or as they say in Las Vegas, he's a shill. He's there to make it look like it has something to do with human beings. The real control is somewhere up the line here.
Okay, how long has this been going on with him, in person?
He had his first experience when he was about 3 years old. He was playing in a garden in Tel Aviv. The Arab neighbors there usually have gardens. At least they did. This is back in 1951, and a being, and whether it's a being or a spaceship, came down in flooding light. He doesn't remember, all he knows is it came down in flooding light, with light, and from there on this thing started. He began to know things, and he began to move kids' watches, and he began to bend things. When he got to be about 7 or 8, he got kind of scared. The kids laughed at him. It wasn't very popular. It didn't make a big hit. And he just put it aside. And when he got through with his 3-year hitch during the 67 war, and he was home and got out and had to make a living, he began to do it seriously because he met a young boy named Shippy, who is still with him today, who somehow triggered him to do it, even though Shippy himself never even tried to do this stuff. And then I might just add a bit of esoterica, which I don't talk about very often, but for Uri to have his powers released, there should be here, and there's Uri here, and there's myself here. And to get any really big things going, the three of us have to agree, even if it's unconscious, 100%, to allow major events to happen. And most of the time, Uri works only with Shippy, and when the two of them are together, he can do considerably powerful things. But if he's alone, he has less power. If the three of us are together and absolutely agree on something, then there's literally a kind of unlimited power. Anything we want to do, we can do. But we don't exercise that because that's a very great privilege. I might just say for this small audience, it's not for public consumption, but for many, many years now, whenever there's a threat of a nuclear crisis, and by that I mean something like the Soviet Union is over here and we're over here, and they have some idea of launching a missile, and this has happened many times. It's a good thing the military don't tell you how many shootdowns we've almost had. But whenever one of these things is going to happen, either from this side, we're also capable of this kind of nonsense. I'm talking about the United States. Roy and I have to go to work and we neutralize or inactivate these things and they don't happen. But that's kind of the peak of the major stuff we get through. Now, have I begun to answer your question? I'm sure not. But that's the general scheme, okay? Yes.
There was one time when Harry was in our dining room and Shippy was upstairs with my daughter, and he said, "Mama, get me out of this dining room. Your sword's going to go." And he says, "I can't stop it." And it went, and I didn't care. But he also told me the same night that he'd never want to have another trip like he had from Biltmore through your wildlife bush down to your bridge. He said, never want to have anything like that. So he was saying he could not control hardly anything.
I might add that Louis is rather frightened of these powers. He's not comfortable with them. He's not happy with them. Sometimes he wishes he were just a regular person who didn't have to be morally responsible to a higher being or be responsible to a lot of other people on earth. And the other thing which you just mentioned, sometimes he feels he can't control these powers. So if you ask Rory about all this stuff, he'll say, I don't believe it, it doesn't exist. He just doesn't want to talk about it. Yes.
Well, I know that one time it only happened to us once. Myself, my daughter, and our car were materialized in Hellwood. We were not frightened at all, but we were completely awestruck. We just sat there crying in the car when it happened. It didn't scare us, we weren't at all, but it happened. It had to happen at that moment, or we would have been on the other side now.
Yeah.
Some
people get so freaked out that they go over the brink. A small example of when I first brought Uri to Germany, which was a cruel thing for me to do, but I had to find out where they could take the world, because after all, Israel is a tiny little provincial country, and in many ways, in spite of what you think, life is very sheltered there in the home life. And he had no idea about the bigger world. So I figured, if I'm going to take this guy, and all I was interested in was scientific validation of the phenomenon and how it works, if I'm going to take him to Cambridge or to Oxford or to Columbia or SRI or wherever we plan to take him, I didn't want him to collapse on me under great pressure. So I figured I'll at least see if this guy can take it. And then the dirtiest place I could have put him into Germany. But anyway, Munich was a tough shake, the shaking down ground. And one of the first experiments that was done by Friedberg Carter from the Max Planck Institute with Geller was they gave him a piece of soldering wire, soft lead, you know. And they held another piece in their hands for control. They wanted to see if he would cause any change in the metal. So he held it in his hand, he gave it back to them, and when he gave it back to them, it was all gold. And later on, when they checked it in mass spectroscopy, all that lead had transmuted to gold. Well, the guy, not Carter, but the guy who was the photographer on that particular experiment, absolutely freaked out, went to the river in Munich, whatever it's called, and dumped all his camera gear and everything into the river and said he'd never look at this kind of phenomenon again in his life. But I can tell you many, many stories about people who have absolutely freaked out. I'm talking about strong, tough, brave people. I'm talking about pilots and people who really are used to dangerous lives. Anyway, it's a very hard thing to go to observe. You're very fortunate that you're pretty cool about all your experiences.
We've had many.
Yeah. Yes.
I was wondering, I know like you would won't deal as much with the empirical aspects, but just where you pull the scientific and the medical aspects to their extreme, and working with the Atlantic group, you know, has there been any aspect of trying to correlate these extremes with the esoteric extremes, working or trying to validate certain aspects of channeling, the ones that work to the greatest, work to the furthest understanding, like working with things that are talking about, I don't know if you've gone into any of the aspects like Urantia, going into the scale communities of the Chicago, groups working esoterically with channelings, with mediumistic aspects that are working to set up, going through the disasters and beyond them, working on remodeling the planet, working with the higher brother groups, the white brotherhood, and trying to validate those within these groups that are working, shall we say, on a more valid migration as a physical.
Okay.